Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. In for Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander. Let's begin on Wall Street, where there was a rally Friday, snapping a five-day drop in the S&P 500 as financial, commodity-related, and other beaten-down shares rebounded for the day, at least. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 313 points, 2%, to 15,974. The S&P 500 added 36 points, 1.94%, to 1,865. And the NASDAQ added 71 points, that's 1.6%, to 4,337. For the week, the Dow was down 1.4%, the S&P was off 0.8%, and the NASDAQ was down 0.6%. Let's take a look at crude oil, and my goodness, what a ride there. Thursday, crude was down over 4%, but Friday, crude was up 12%. That had an impact at the Chicago Board of Trade as well, where soy oil, for the fifth week in a row, was higher thanks to the support from crude oil. Soy oil was up 1.9% for the week, and soy meal was down 1.1%. Other ag commodities, corn and wheat, were lower for the week. Beans were slightly higher. Friday, corn was down a penny and a quarter at $3.59 a bushel, a four-week low, and down 1.8% for the week, largely because of technical selling and also because there is just a lot of corn all around the world. Soybeans down three-quarters of a cent at $8.72¾ on Friday, but for the week was up 0.6%. And wheat was down three-quarters of a cent at $4.57½ a bushel on Friday. During the trading session, it touched 455, the lowest since 2010. For the week, wheat was down 9¼¢, 2%, the second weekly decline. We will dive into the equities with our special guest, Susan Schmidt of Westwood Holdings, after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
You're listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And my guest today is Susan Schmidt, portfolio manager with Westwood Holdings in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Let's talk about what happened. Volatility, our old friend, is still alive and well.
Oh, it is lovely. Huh? I know it's keeping, keeping a lot of doctors in business as people's anxiety levels are going through the roof. So we have a lot of volatility. You're seeing it across all different trading metrics. You're seeing it certainly in the price of oil. If anyone was looking at the price of oil, jump around all week. It's up 12% today after plummeting earlier this week. And you're seeing it in the treasuries. We haven't seen this kind of volatility in, you know, the 10-year yield in truly years, decades. And so we're seeing that. And then all of that combined, you've got those two things going on that spills over into the stock market. And so we're seeing the same thing in equities. A lot of movement there, a lot of concern.
Okay. Well, there's no simple answer, but I'll ask anyway. What's the cause of all the volatility across such a wide range?
Such a wide range. And so I will say that it really is emotion. And it's a little bit of fear, I believe, creeping into the market right now. So we're concerned about the global economy. We're concerned about coming out of this recession, having economic numbers and data come out that are still positive. The central banks are doing a lot to try and promote growth and promote economies. But we saw this week people move and the central banks move to negative interest rates. And that is scary to a lot of people in the markets because it seems like if we need that much help, things must be bad.
Well, explain how negative interest rates work.
Negative interest rates are, this does not mean that when you go and you put your money in your savings account in the bank, they're going to take it away from you and give you back less. But what it does mean is that if I'm a bank and I have a lot of deposits, and as a bank, my job and my business is taking those deposits and then using them as a source of funds to loan out to businesses. And when you have a negative interest rate, when I have those deposits and I'm sitting on them, then suddenly now I'm sitting on them and my bank effectively is the Federal Reserve. So we do not have negative interest rates in the U.S., but we'll use the Federal Reserve as an example. If we did, then the Federal Reserve would charge those banks for holding those deposits on behalf of the banks. And so that is a negative interest rate because the bank would be paying a tiny little fee to have the Fed do that for them. And so what the Fed or these central banks are doing by going to negative interest rates is encouraging the banks, we don't want you sitting on the deposits. We don't want you holding on to them. We want you to promote growth. We want you to be taking on loans. We want you to be finding businesses. And so it's really meant as a way to stimulate the economy and get banks out there lending. Banks who are hesitant to lend or holding back, this is a great way to incent them to go out and come back to lending to the local economies.
So we saw that happen in Japan and also the ECB as well.
Yes. So the ECB, we did see that. And, you know, we've seen in the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've seen some issues in the ECB. There's concern over the European recovery. And we've had Draghi, who's president of the ECB, come out and speak and talk about supporting the economies. So he's done that very successfully in the past. He's talked about it a lot where he hasn't actually always had to do anything. He's just said that he will. But now, again, he's talking about it. And the supposition is that he will do something and potentially go back into the market and start buying corporate bonds, but again, trying to lower interest rates, promote growth in the economy, really support some sort of stimulus to get things back on track.
So let's talk about emotion again. And for the typical investor, who's probably somebody that holds a 401k.
Right.
Should they be panicking right now?
No. And I think it's really important when you think about that, because the typical investor sees all this activity and says, wow, this is really scary. And it is scary. But when you have a 401k or your IRA, remember that that is long-term money. So it's not meant to be something that, you know, you hold, you have invested and you haven't invested for 3 months and then you're going to use it somewhere else. This is money that probably is still in its account and meant to be there for years. And so when you look at that kind of time frame, you have to remember that the longer you're there over a longer period of time, risk takes care of itself. And so the volatility, it might be down now, but it also might be up. And so you're riding through that. And over the course of multiple years, then the investment can actually recover. It'll be fine for you. But when you look at it and you see the news coming out in the media, that's, you know, no one wants to come out and say we have okay news. We want it to be really good or really bad. We're not good with okay news. That's not how America works. So you want to have a long-term view and not get emotional one way or the other. It's not fabulous time to invest. It's not a terrible time to invest. It's a rational investment that you want to make. So 401ks, IRAs, just remember, that's long-term money. Yes, there's volatility now. This too shall pass. Ride it out.
It's long-term money for some people. For others, perhaps, who are within 5 or 10 years of retirement, they have a much shorter window.
They do have a shorter window. And so when you're looking at that 5 to 10 years out, I would say that, you know, you want to be conscious of the bets that you're making. It's difficult to find yield investments right now, right? Treasuries are we've talked about this, but, you know, 1.7% on a 10-year, that's the interest rate you're going to get. Banks, we're talking about them going negative. Well, that means that if you're in a savings account, they won't take money away from you, but they're certainly not going to give you a lot of money. So your interest rate is very low, if at all, existent. So instead, it is looking for that 5 to 10 year horizon. I still think equities are a great place to be because they do offer returns and they do offer yield. We're seeing an emotional flight now, and we're interest. This is a wonderful fact, and we've mentioned it before. But since in the last 12 months, if we look back and we look at the outflows from the equity markets, they're twice what they were in 2008. Do things feel twice as bad as they were in 2008?
No.
Not at all. Right. No. Not at all. Not even close.
In fact, so, we've had some fairly decent news about the economy.
We've had reasonable news. Companies are making money. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have concerns about companies failing and balance sheets not being true.
Employment?
Employment is good. Consumer confidence today was still positive. We're seeing good underpinnings of the economy here. And in fact, we're seeing a positive rise in households. Perhaps a softening in business, but household confidence and household incomes actually look to be going up. So net-net, again, this too shall pass. Ride it out. And when you have a 5 to 10 year horizon, it's tough to be in fixed income, so yielding instruments right now, which is normally where you would go to for safety and security. Mm-hmm. However, we're in a new era. So when we look back in December and saw the Fed meeting in December, the 10-year Treasury at that point was 2.3%. You know, we looked at it yesterday in the middle of panic. Everybody wanted to buy Treasuries. The yield on it was, you know, 1.5% in a little bit. That's a really big swing in such a short period of time. Yeah. So fixed income instruments, government bonds, they're not the security and the safety that they used to be. Mm-hmm. So again, long-term money, you're just going to have to be cautious and thoughtful about how you want to manage your investments.
What about corporate bonds?
Corporate bonds are very interesting right now because you're seeing a huge dichotomy. So corporations that have solid businesses, not a lot of debt, people are very comfortable with their ongoing operations. Those corporate bonds are trading at very low yields. So you don't have to pay a lot to get them. You're not going to have to get, the corporation doesn't have to pay the consumer, the investor a lot to have them take the bond because the consumer, and here the consumer is an investor, wants interest, right? I want yield from something. So a corporate bond is in high demand. And when it's in high demand, that means it doesn't have to give very much interest rate away to get someone to take on that debt. However, if you are a risky company and you are a high yield company, so high yield means I'm going to have to pay a higher degree of interest to get someone interested and comfortable in holding my debt. That's for a company whose business is not so stable and does have some risk. And so right now, perfect example is energy-related companies, where people are very nervous about the longevity of those companies. The high-yield market, instead, is showing a lot of concern, and it's very expensive to issue debt because you have to pay a lot of interest to get people comfortable to hold on to it.
Mm-hmm. Susan Schmitz, my guest. You're listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And let's talk about the big wild card here that we have not mentioned yet, and that is Red Monkey Year. Red Fire Monkey. That is the Chinese New Year, which began on the 4th. And as you were mentioning to me off the air earlier.
So I think this is really interesting, and no one's talking about it this week, but Chinese New Year began on the 4th. We're in Chinese New Year, which means that Chinese market activity is non-existent. And we are about to come out of that, where we are going to see the Chinese market resume activity, full activity, on Sunday night, this weekend. So Monday for them, they'll be up and running and start trading.
And we'll be closed.
Mm-hmm. So it's really, I think, an interesting point, and it's good to know because you might see some really wild swings on Monday. The Chinese markets are going to have to do a lot of catching up. They've been basically frozen and unable to participate as the world has swung around up, down, and sideways. And now we're going to see that activity in the Chinese market. We'll see if they are following or they're leading or they've managed to stay calm throughout.
So in Wall Street, the Dow was down for the week about 1.4%. The
right.
S&P was down 0.8%, 0.6% for the NASDAQ. So would you expect, in terms of catching up, would you expect China to be trying somewhere matching those levels in one day, perhaps?
I think that more so than matching the levels, remember, when we see things in China and they usually swing in a much greater magnitude. Mm-hmm. So it's accentuated. And I think that what we'll see in China is probably a down market and probably a little bit more than we felt here in the U.S. because they're concerned, they're catching up. They're also concerned about the world economy. And it's a more, we have volatility. The Chinese market really has volatility.
Right.
So it's much more volatility than we have. And I think you're going to see that in that impact. Ultimately, does it all settle out? Yes, it does. But if you look at it from day to day or minute to minute, you know, the swings up and down seem very large and very frequent.
Well, on a day-to-day basis, perhaps they'll look at the big gain today.
Which would be great. And so if that carries through, that's actually very positive because they'll say, all right, we did get some good economic data today. We did get, you know, good reports on retail sales. We did see a lot of confidence underlying in households and consumer confidence. Households are feeling good about how they're situated for the next years. And they feel good about interest rates. They feel good about their income. They're optimistic about the future. That's a very big positive for our day-to-day economy and moving forward. So hopefully, yes, when the Chinese market opens, they can focus on that. And that's a good news event for mm-hmm. them, and hopefully that market will be a little bit calmer.
Or maybe they'll come in and devalue the yuan again. And
the Chinese government, I think, had a harsh awakening when they realized what kind of impact that would have in the devaluation of the yuan. Remember that China also wants to be a reserve currency for the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. So the IMF, for reserve currencies, wants to have a basket of currencies that it feels comfortable with, that are safe havens, that are stable, that will hold value. Mm-hmm. And so to devalue the yuan, that is a difficult thing, because the IMF is going to look at that and say, well, that's not such a safe haven.
Right.
That doesn't seem very stable if they're doing that. And therefore, I'm not sure that do we want to approve this currency to mm-hmm. be part of our, approved currency list of basket of safe havens. So I think the Chinese government, which is very status conscious, wants to have that approval from the IMF. Devaluing again might be difficult for them.
So back to equities. Back in the old days, long before you and I were even thinking about this type of thing, there were stocks that our parents and other relatives got into, like Ma Bell.
Right. The old blue chips.
Yeah, the old blue chips that they would get, they'd hang on
tried
to.
Tried and true. They were safe. You could own them for 50 years and everything was great.
Are there any of those left?
No. That's the simple answer. No, there really aren't. And it's not the same market that our parents, our grandparents mm-hmm. got to invest in. It's a very different market today. So we have a lot of hedge funds. We talk about high frequency trading. There's a lot of people who use the market as a means to make money or turn a profit and try to manipulate it, try to leverage that up and down. And even if they're only making, when we talk about high frequency traders, they're leveraging a difference where they might only make 1 cent on a mm-hmm. trade, or half a penny on it. But because they've got such volume behind it, if you do that millions of times, then suddenly it's actually worthwhile and profitable for you to do. So we're seeing more pressure in the markets. We're seeing things move around more. And remember that we are seeing a vastly different technology platform, and because of that, a changing consumer. So we saw this. A great example is, bricks and mortar versus online. Look at how much sales has shifted to online. Mm-hmm. When we look at the recent holiday shopping season. Technology. AT&T, you don't use your phone like you did 10 years ago. Now you have a cell phone. You may not even have a landline. And so, again, shifting platforms. So I think in my mind, you really don't have that 50-year horizon, 30-year horizon on these old blue-chip stocks where you can be in something and ride it out and just not look at the changing world around you.
One of the closest, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but one of the closest, at least in my mind, to that type of a stock up until just recently was Apple. I thought that Apple was, it was on a steady increase.
And if you look at it in a short enough time frame, it certainly was. But if we go back to the start of Apple and you go pre-tech boom and pre-tech bubble and the crash in 2000 and you look back on Apple, it has had some big ups and downs. And when you think about the old blue chips, the beauty of those was there were no big ups and downs. It was steady. It was like a passbook savings account. It just kind of clocked in a dividend yield and you felt okay about
it. That was the market overall, too. We didn't ever have the volatility.
That was the market overall. Yeah. And so now, because of the volatility, that's why it also makes it a little more anxious for our 401k IRA investors to look at it for the long term. It's hard to remind yourself that you're doing this for a multi-year horizon. And if you get caught up in the day-to-day because the moves have become so big and because we have so much attention on it now, it does make everyone nervous. It makes them look at it twice and say, wow, am I really doing the right thing? I have wealth that's at risk here. I want to make sure my retirement is safe. It's human nature to worry. That's what we do. It's also human nature to panic.
Right.
Professional investors count on people panicking and human nature taking over, because when that happens, generally it's at the worst possible time and the professional investor is waiting to take that opportunity and eventually be able to turn it into a profit.
Waiting there with ice in your veins, ice water in your veins.
Yes, I think the professional investors are those who are really great at what they do are those who are looking at things and are really able to isolate the emotion from it, look at the company and the stock as if it's an investment. What is the return? What are the potentials here for this company going forward? What is this company going to earn over the next number of years? And when they look at that, ice in their veins, cold-hearted, but just pure play, here's a cash flow stream. What is that worth? That helps a lot in being able to make a rational decision at any point in time.
Removing the emotion, you know, that's a good thing, right?
And really hard to do.
So why have the equities been following oil so, you know, up and down?
There's a concern that with the volatility in oil, it's reflective of volatility in the global economy. And equities are businesses. Businesses then reflect economies. And the equities are moving when they see oil move as much as it does, because now equities are concerned that that is an indicator for a slowdown in the global economy. Remember that oil is priced now at $29. Yesterday it actually hit 26.
Yeah.
We were sub 30, and then we bounced up above 30 once again, and people were feeling better. Now we're sub 30 again, and that's very concerning. If we go back a year and a half, oil was above $100 a barrel.
Right.
So this slowdown is because ultimately in economics, price is set by supply and demand. So you get two things. You've got a lot of supply coming online, and then you have a softening in demand. China doesn't need as much oil as it had before. There's concern that Europe isn't using as much oil, and that's because their economies are not as vibrant as they were before. So hence the price of oil falls. The markets look at that and say, wow, that must mean that the economy is bad. Business isn't good if economies are bad. And so you see a lot of volatility in the markets and people back away because they're getting scared and really want to avoid exposure.
It's always interesting.
It's always entertaining.
Susan Schmidt, Portfolio Manager at Westwood Holdings in Dallas. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Dennis Smith of Archer Financial Services joins us this week in the studio. And are we going to get any answer at all on this roller coaster ride the cattle market has been undergoing the past several months?
Well, the CME is working towards some solutions. Shortening trading hours is one solution. That starts at the last day of February, so basically the month of March. Will the shortened hours reduce volatility? We'll see. Certainly, they've shortened hours with the market close at 1:05 instead of 4 o'clock. So we've almost gone full circle with the trading hours. A little bit of a concern on my behalf. Livestock and grain will be opening at the same time. And I've only been doing this for 30 years, but I've never seen the livestock and grain markets open at the same time. But the CME is very proactive in working toward solutions, trying to smooth out the volatility, if you would, in live cattle futures.
Well, I know Terry Duffy, who runs the CME Group, spoke at the National Cattlemen's Convention and got an earful on volatility and seems to be responding. They're talking, what, circuit breaker for those limit days?
Yeah, circuit breakers, some messaging situations for the high-frequency traders, which, honestly, I do not totally understand. One of my biggest concerns, and I know this is one of Terry Duffy's biggest concerns, is a lack of cash market activity during market hours. You need to have some cash trade while the market is trading to allow everybody, including the hedgers, a chance to square up positions.
And, of course, Terry started at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange as a hog trader, as I recall.
That's right. So certainly there's an understanding of the complexities and the problems, and everybody seems to be focused towards solution.
Okay, let's talk about the cattle market. It seems now it's tied into Wall Street. Wall Street goes down, cattle go down.
Yeah, the correlation has been pretty high and quite noticeable, but it's a global market, a global situation, and we are apparently going through a global slowdown in economic growth. Export sales, as far as beef exports, certainly demonstrate that. Recent data showed beef exports in December down 8%, and that is not a good number. Exports to our largest customers down significantly. So we are going through a global situation here, and it certainly is impacting live cattle futures.
The Japanese market still holding fairly well?
We've seen a slowdown in beef trade with Japan. Pork trade has been very good, but the Japanese economy is got its own set of problems, as well as the Chinese economy. So the continued slowdown in the Asian economies overall is not good for live cattle prices.
And the U.S. herd rebuilding is definitely underway.
Most definitely in an aggressive type fashion. We're now into our second year. Typically means production will start increasing basically in the second half of this year.
And as you look at the cattle industry, everybody is hurting, but who's hurting the most?
Well, I think it's at the feedlot on the closeouts of the fed cattle. They've been losing substantial amounts of money throughout all of 2015, all of last year. And if they're not able to secure replacements, feeder cattle at lower prices, I'm afraid we're looking at another long string of losses on closeouts. So it's definitely substantial losses at the feedlot.
One of the conversation points at the convention in San Diego was the fact that 2014 was probably one of the best years they've ever had, but after that, it's been straight downhill.
Boy, things have changed in a hurry, and the frustrating part about last year is prices had declined roughly 16% before production even began increasing, and that's the real complexity of market that is certainly difficult to understand. Now we're going to start increasing production, and it does appear like more price pressures are underway.
And the February USDA report on stocks, any surprises and beneficial or not to livestock producers?
A little bit surprised that the meat supply demand table showed a small downward revision in beef production for this year based upon smaller placements of animals in the fourth quarter of last year. That's good. However, we are expecting placements to be active into the summer months and are expected to see increased beef production, say, by the fourth quarter of this year.
Back to hog production, as I've attended meetings in the upper Midwest the past 2 or 3 months, I keep hearing about construction companies that build swine barns have had a sharp increase. But you bring a different look to that.
Yeah, I'm hearing the same thing, but there's a changing industry going on with the more producers moving out of the farrow to finish business and moving into the finish business. And I believe, and I can't prove this, but a lot of these finishing buildings are going up. It's not necessarily going to increase production, but we've got producers who are raising somebody else's hogs. So packer-owned inventory moving into someone else that is being paid to finish those hogs. New facility, perhaps not a substantially larger production.
Final question, Dennis, as always, what, if anything, should cattle and hog producers be doing in the market now?
Well, you have to be very active. In my opinion, we've been utilizing the options markets, trying to get a price floor with a ceiling above the market, a strategy we call marketing window. And it's certainly helps dealing with the volatility, which, of course, has been rampant. So we are very aggressive about hedging in live cattle and feeder cattle, much less aggressive in the hog market right now.
We always appreciate your expertise, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Dennis Smith, livestock analyst, Archer Financial Services.
Thank you, Big O. That's the markets for this week, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson, I'm Steve Alexander.